Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, cutting down on carbon for Lent. Aid agencies suggest new ways of marking this traditional season of prayer, fasting and almsgiving. Religious values in a secular society. The Archbishop of Canterbury's comments over the use of Islamic Sharia law cause controversy in Britain. And education as the key to development. A new World Bank report warns the Arab world is falling behind. During the start of this Lenten season, Pope Benedict is currently following a daily programme of spiritual exercises, together with members of the Curia and the papal household. Throughout this week-long period of prayer, meditation and reflections on the scriptures, the Pope is not holding any public or private audiences, including his Wednesday general audience. These exercises end on Saturday morning with a final meditation led this year by French Cardinal Albert Vanoir. For all of us, Lent is a time of personal reflection and repentance, a time to reconsider our relationship with God and His creation, and a time to put others' needs before our own. For Christians, the 40 days of Lent are a vital time of preparation for Easter by reviewing our own lifestyles and drawing closer to God through prayer, fasting, and giving to those in need. So what are you giving up this Lent?
Chocolate, whiskey, I'm giving up some of my carbon. That's an easy conversation to have, and it's a good way to show the church being relevant in the world and doing something positive.
Ben Niblett is head of campaigns with the ecumenical aid agency Tear Fund, which, like many charities and development agencies, is increasingly focusing on climate change as a key to fighting poverty in the poorest countries. This Lent, Tear Fund is urging people to go on a carbon fast and find out exactly how such actions here in the West can directly affect communities in the developing world.
The idea is that everybody knows what Lent is, and many people give up something like chocolate. And we wanted to take that and turn it into something more useful that served poor people better and ask people to give up some of their carbon instead. So we wanted to make it easy and give 40 simple things you can do throughout Lent that will start you down the path of reducing your carbon emissions and also get you in the habit of thinking about it. And that includes some campaign actions so that politicians get the message the church cares about climate change, because God does and because it's important. And it includes some prayers and some reflection, as well as the actions like changing your transport habits.
So you're offering people a pack with an instruction for every day, a different action for every day of Lent, is that right?
Yeah, there's 40 different things you could do. There's a pack you can get as a paper pack. It's just a little booklet. It's got 40 days worth of things in it and a bit of explanation about why you should do it. And you can get the same thing online, or we can email you day by day with the day's thing. And obviously we'd rather you went online to get it, because there's more carbon emissions in producing the booklet. But booklets work better for many people, particularly if you're using it at church. So last Sunday, my church and many others gave one to everybody, and they went down very well.
So this is aimed particularly at a Catholic audience, is it?
Well, it's an Anglican idea. So it's the Bishop of Liverpool trialled this last year, and then we decided to work with him this year to make it national. But Lent is for anybody of any denomination.
And what kind of reaction have you had from people in Britain? You say everybody knows what Lent is, but in Britain today I'm not quite so sure that that's really true.
I think the habit of giving up something for Lent is a cultural thing that's widely known. People might not know why they're giving up something in Lent, but they know that it's something people do. And that makes it a good chance to go and have that conversation at the bus stop or with your neighbour or your colleague and say, what are you giving up this Lent? Chocolate? Whiskey? I'm giving up some of my carbon. That's an easy conversation to have, and it's a good way to show the church being relevant in the world and doing something positive. And I think the church has a special message on climate change, because it's easy to get despairing about climate change. the size of the problem, the scale of the changes we need. And the church has a message of hope to say, yes, we can do this. And what's more, the prospect of consuming a bit less than we do at the moment is actually going to be good for us and make us happier than we already are.
Many of these issues you're talking about are contained in Pope Benedict's message for Lent this year. He talks particularly about the fact that we are not owners, but rather administrators or stewards of all the material goods of this earth. This is particularly applicable to the kind of campaign you're spearheading, isn't it?
It certainly is. I think that's maybe a message we're more used to hearing about our money and about our time than about the earth's resources and the way we use them. So we've got used to consumer convenience and thinking we have a right to do whatever makes our lives easier. And once we discover that what we do has an impact on climate change, and climate change hits the world's poorest people hardest, and the effect it's having on them now, then we have to change our attitude. So it's not as though we were doing any harm on purpose. It was an accident. So if I drive to the shops or catch a plane to go to family wedding or just turn the heating up because I fancy being really warm this evening, those things are perfectly innocent things, but they cause damage. And once I know about the damage, I have responsibility to rethink how I behave.
What kind of reaction have you had from people? Because although it may be easy for them to see that if they're giving some money, for example, to a project in a developing country, it's easy to see how that can help. It's much harder to help people understand how these kind of actions can make a real impact on people's lives there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the Tear Fund serves poor communities, whatever their beliefs. And if you care about poverty, if you care about justice, that means you have to start caring about climate change, because we can see the impact that's happening now. So I've heard from farmers in every continent where we work that the weather has been strange recently and it's harder to make a living. So the rains don't come when they used to, or they don't come at all, or they start and then stop, or there are floods and there's too much rain at one point and droughts later in the year. And all of this makes it very hard for people whose lives are already hard to make a living. And we have a responsibility. Once we discover that, we have to do something about it. And as you say, giving money is still very useful. And we have to help poor communities adapt to climate change. So change the crops to more drought-resistant ones, change the farming methods, have early warning systems because of disasters, because there are going to be more disasters now. But money alone can't do all of what we need. We need prayer, which is another special thing that the church can do, obviously. And we need campaigning action so that we're calling on our governments, on the British government and each government of the world, to tackle climate change and to do it together and to do it fast enough. And we also need to change our own lifestyles and cut our own carbon emissions. It's just a responsibility that we have. But it's also a good way of the church giving a lead. And I think that's my vision, really, that I'm excited that the church can start giving a lead on climate change. It's got good reasons to talk about it, because, as you say, we are under orders to care for the planet. We're under orders to care for the poor. And we know that overconsumption is a false god that's going to damage us. So it shouldn't be a surprise to see the bad things that happen as a result. So I think the church is well placed to give this lead, and I hope the Carbon Fast will help do that. And I'm encouraged that well over 250,000 people have got this Carbon Fast, and that's an awful lot of people.
When you say over 250,000, how do you know that? How do you know those figures?
That's the mixture of people who've either rung us and ordered a booklet, or have ordered it online, or have been sent one because they're already Tear Fund supporters and have asked for more of these kinds of things. I don't know how many people are just visiting the website and doing it that way. I hope there are thousands more.
Do you think the church could perhaps be doing more, hasn't taken a strong enough leadership role up till now?
I think it's time we led as much as we could, yeah, and across denominations and across countries. So particularly in the States, it's encouraging to see Christians starting to talk about climate change, to recognise that it's real and to see that it's something God has put on our agenda that we ought to be talking about. That's particularly important for the US because they're the biggest emitting country.
You were talking about some of the countries you've visited, people talking about the impact of climate change on their ability to work, to earn a living. Can you give us a couple of very specific examples of places where you hope that actions by people here in the West may actually make a difference in countries where you are working?
Yeah, there's Malawi in southern Africa is a very poor country, and recently a church that Tear Fund works with there told us this story, and we met people there. So the pastor of that church, his name is Cuthbert Gondwe, told us about the flood that the villagers had. So in that part of the world, there are usually two crops a year, and the soil is good, and it's a good place to make a living if you're an African farmer. But last year, there was a drought for the first harvest, and they didn't harvest, and then there was a flood, and the river flooded and damaged the crops for the second harvest, and worse still, it dumped about a metre of sand over the farmers' fields. And so we know a family called the McGlasses, whose names are Andrew and Grace, and they told us it used to take 30 seconds to plant a seed in the ground, so you could get a good crop planted and a good harvest. But because of the sand, it takes about half an hour. How are you going to make a living then? And so the church we work with there has distributed drought-resistant crops, has helped organise the village so that they can dig sand off each other's fields, has helped put an embankment by the river to reduce the risk of flooding. And those are the practical things we can do on the ground, that we can use the prayers and the money of people in rich countries. But also, they tell us that if we don't start cutting our carbon emissions now, we're going to see situations like that again and again and again across Malawi, across Southern Africa, across the developing world. So it's a good warning sign to us to get on with it.
And my thanks there to Ben Niblett, Head of Campaigns with the British-based aid and development agency Tear Fund. The Church of England has been holding its General Synod or National Assembly this week amid controversy over comments made by the Archbishop of Canterbury regarding the use of some provisions of Islamic Sharia law in Britain. In a lecture to legal experts and again in a radio interview, Archbishop Rowan Williams reflected on whether British law could or should allow more recognition of a person's religious identity and values. While a few commentators praised the Archbishop for raising crucial questions over the place of religion within secular British society, their voices were largely drowned out by a storm of angry reactions and inflammatory newspaper headlines.
And at the moment, I feel the level of debate with not just Islam, but with organised religion of any kind is something which really gets under people's skin. Is quite extraordinary and really quite depressing at the moment.
Jesuit Father Michael Barnes is a former professor at Rome's Gregorian University and current head of the Centre for Christianity and Interreligious Dialogue at London's Heathrop College. He told me he's shocked and saddened by the widespread fear and ignorance giving rise to such reactions.
Yes, very surprised and really rather disappointed by the level of reaction. I think what happened was that he found himself in a position where he was going to give the lecture in the evening, which interestingly is one of a series on Islam and the law. And this was going to be a typically Rowan Williams dense investigation of all sorts of theoretical issues. And I suspect his advisors said, this is going to be picked up and probably misunderstood. You need to defuse it before you ever get there. And so he gave us the radio broadcast, which was a very measured conversation. But when I heard it at first, I thought, well, he's going to touch upon issues here which will upset a lot of people. And I think the problem is, in this country, as soon as you mention Sharia law, all the worst aspects of Islam begin to emerge in people's minds. And that's what they picked up. Nobody was looking forward to the lecture in the evening and considering what he might actually say there. And I think it was just one remark. It was one remark in that broadcast, which was picked up quite early on, where the question was put to him about is Sharia law unavoidable, and he more or less agreed with that and said yes, and that's as far as it went.
Why do you think that this issue upsets people so much? Is it ignorance about what Sharia law really is? Is it prejudice? Is it a genuine fear of losing some kind of Christian identity?
I think it's all of those things. I think there's a great deal of fear and ignorance of Islam. I think there is a very deep-seated concern that we are, and there's truth in this, nourishing a certain type of extremist Islam in our midst. The 7/7 bombers, you know, famously came from our own inner cities. Where I live around Southall, it would not surprise me at all if you had a few little groups like this I think for a lot of people it's really quite worrying. But of course the problem is everybody then thinks of Islam in terms of its worst extremist elements, and they are a tiny, tiny minority.
Archbishop Rowan would argue that in order to combat this extremism, you need to engage with the vast majority of moderate Muslims. Is this a viable point of view?
Yes, it is. It is. And there are plenty of examples of how Muslims themselves are beginning to take on this agenda of much more active integration. I mean, at least in the sense that they are themselves trying to be much more conscious of the role that they play in civic society. Only yesterday I was with a very interesting group of Shia Muslims, and I think this was the first time they'd put on an interfaith event. Normally they would have a celebration themselves for Imam Hussein Day, that was what it was all about, but this one was deliberately interfaith. And I was invited along to give a talk to them about Christianity and Islam. And it was a wonderful occasion. And coming away from that, you say to yourself, well, what is wrong with interfaith relations in this country? This is just so positive. But that is one community, and one particularly, I think, well-integrated and really quite sophisticated community that is able to present itself and to present itself well. You have to face the fact that not all Muslim communities in this country are capable of doing that.
You lecture as well, don't you, at a Muslim college there in London. There have been a variety of reactions from within the Muslim communities in Britain, as you say. What do you think perhaps can be done to encourage these more moderate voices?
Well, I think the conversations have to continue, and people who have got links, contacts with Muslims have to go on trying to keep these lines of communication open. I think there are many positive points to build on. What I think is worrying that you still have a perception that Islam is something which is intrinsically foreign to this country, that Muslims do not want to integrate, and the fact that they have some sort of loyalty to another identity which is not British. It's perceived as not British and can't possibly be British. This is what really upsets not just a lot of people in the street who are worried about their Muslim neighbours and not being able to understand them. It's also something which is taken on by, I think, a lot of the intelligentsia. And at the moment, I feel the level of debate with not just Islam, but with organised religion of any kind is something which really gets under people's skin. It is quite extraordinary and really quite depressing at the moment.
Archbishop Williams' speech was in fact looking at the space for religious rights as a whole, not just Islam, within the country's legal system, wasn't it? Do you share his views on the possibility of doing this, of somehow looking more closely at the legal system as it stands and perhaps renegotiating more space for religion?
Well, he's concerned, I think, with some very complex theoretical issues about citizenship, about religion in civic society. That's his general theme, and it comes up time and time again. What do you do when people have dual identities in some sense? They're citizens of this country, and they consider themselves to be citizens of this country, and yet they're believers within what he calls a community of conviction. So I think what he's discerning always is the tension which exists between two types of identity. I just wonder myself whether in practice he's not underestimating the capacity that people have for negotiating ways between those two identities. I'm impressed by a few Muslims that I've met in the last few days who have expressed a view that, well, they're very happy living under the law in this country. They feel a lot freer than they might do places which they've come from, and they look at it very, very positively.
How much does this debate have to do with the established role of the Church of England in the country today, do you think?
I think it probably has a lot to say to the quite complex position that the Church of England upholds within the country, both as the mainstream Christian tradition and as as it were, the moral conscience of the nation, and there's the tension. I think a lot of people will, a lot of Anglicans and Christians generally, I think, will accept that the Church of England has a role to play in trying to develop these debates about the place of religion in society. And I find that a lot of people of faith are quite prepared to say, this is a Christian country. I've heard Muslims say this. This is a Christian country, and that's the dominating religious ethos. And we need to preserve that, because within that sort of umbrella, faith has a place. And our faith has a place. So they're quite prepared to go along with the sort of protective role that the Church of England classically has played within the nation.
What about reactions from the Catholic Church there in Britain? How have they reacted to this furor?
The Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac, has been very supportive. Certainly the remarks he made, I think, were, I thought, very helpful. One of the issues that was around for us quite recently was the whole question of our own adoption agencies and how we could operate within the law of the land. And actually, Rowan Williams in the lecture does draw attention to that. In some ways, I feel that if he'd used that as the example, rather than starting with Sharia law and then gone on to talk in some depth about the relationship between the universal law of the land and the sense of commitment which religious people have, if he'd used that as the example, there wouldn't have been any problem at all. The fact that he brings in Islam, of course, just raises people's hackles.
You direct the Interfaith Centre there. How is this going to affect your work? It must be quite difficult at the moment, isn't it?
My feeling is that there isn't going to be an overreaction. What I have picked up is a slight unease, an unhappiness with the fact that this has been raised at all. I think a lot of Muslims just feel that they are under so much pressure, so much exposure in the media, that, you know, one more row, which was not of their making, just makes life more difficult for them. I think the people who are going to suffer will be those who do, in the Muslim community, those who have a public profile, and there's a good number of them who are regularly dragged out in order to talk to the media and whatever. And they're the ones who are going to be debating the merits of Islam, once again, the problems of terrorism, religion in a pluralist society, all this sort of thing is going to come out. And when you get into these public debates, especially the way the media in this country, I'm afraid, are set up at the moment, you generate much more heat than you do light.
And my thanks there to Jesuit Father Michael Barnes, Director of Studies at the Centre for Christianity and Interreligious Dialogue at London's Heythrop College. The World Bank says the quality of education in the Arab world is falling behind other regions and needs urgent reforms to stop unemployment rising among the region's high youth population. A recent report from the World Bank says although education is becoming more accessible and the gender gap has decreased, the Arab world has not witnessed the positive changes seen in Asia and Latin America, particularly in literacy rates and enrollment in secondary schools and universities. The report says Arab states must make education their top priority because it goes hand in hand with security and economic development.
I agree totally that education is really the key to development.
Well, those views are shared by Father Etienne Renaud, Dean of Studies at Rome's Pontifical Institute for Arabic and Islamic Studies.
I would agree also that there is a kind of maybe regression in the quality of education. In the beginning, I wouldn't put it totally on the Arab world. I think it's unfortunately a little bit common to many other countries of the third world, you know. The problem of growth of population, and it's very difficult to follow by the Ministry of Education, you know. Number of children per classes, equipment for the schools, teachers, and the rest. This is common to all the developing countries, you see. But maybe there is a couple of reasons which could be a bit more specific, if I may say so, to the Arab world. First of all, you have a problem with the language itself. Well, Arabic is not an easy language, and everybody knows. But you have, you know, the people at home speak, and in the street, speak colloquial Arabic. At school, they have to learn literary Arabic. It seems a little bit abstract to them. And then add to that, that they have to go very often through foreign language, very early in their education, let it be English or French. So that brings quite a few difficulties for the young pupils. Then maybe Islam is bringing another aspect of that question of education. You know that the Muslims are extremely respectful of the Quran and that they insist very much in learning the Quran by heart. And they have a high respect for all the children and the adults who are able to recite, you know, full parts of the Quran, if not the full Quran. And this worked based only on memory, without any type of reflection. And what you learn, I think, is you find it in all the levels of education. An insistence on learning by heart, on memory, more than on trying to understand. You know what I mean? Then I could say, I could even see concretely, because I have traveled in a few countries, that the statistics of education sometimes include the Quranic schools in their statistic. And in the Quranic school, what is called madrasa, it's totally, practically geared on learning by heart the Quran, reading the Quran, and maybe a little bit of reading. And this is considered as education, and yet it's just an aspect, and it's quite insufficient, you see. And I think that is to be added to the question we can put on the general level of education in the Arab world.
Thanks there to Father Etienne Renault of the Pontifical Institute for Arabic and Islamic Studies. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the Vatican Radio's English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.